The Bodhisattva of compassion, when he meditated deeply, saw the emptiness of all five skandhas and sundered the bonds that caused him suffering. And later we're told, holding to nothing whatever, but dwelling in perfect wisdom, the Bodhisattva is freed of delusive hindrance, rid of the fear bred by it, and reaches clearest nirvana. So what do these two statements mean, these two statements that we're very familiar with from the Heart Sutra, and how are they connected with the fearlessness of the Buddha? Why is it that the Buddha is fearless and we are not? What special qualities does he have that we don't? And what qualities render him beyond the reach of this most powerful of human emotions? It's said that all fear is related to the fear of death. That's the big fear behind all other fears. We fear loss. We fear losing what gives us pleasure. We fear losing what gives us security. But ultimately, we fear losing ourselves. We fear death. But the Buddha was fearless. He was without fear. He didn't fear death. Why not? Well, we must assume because he was free of delusive hindrance. He was free of delusive hindrance, and he was free of the fear that was bred by it. So what does that mean, to be free of delusive hindrance? Maybe there's a clue in that opening line of the Heart Sutra. Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, had meditated deeply, and he had seen the emptiness of all five skandhas, and consequently he had sundered the bonds that had caused him suffering. So what are we to make of this? He had meditated deeply. So whatever realization he had had, he didn't happen upon it by chance. He didn't even happen upon it by reflection. He came upon it by meditating deeply. This is something that I'll return to later in the talk, when I've clarified what's meant by emptiness and the five skandhas. So what emerged from this deep meditation was that he saw the emptiness of all five skandhas. So what does emptiness mean? It's a word that's seemingly ubiquitous in Buddhist circles, but one that's open to misinterpretation. It simply means empty of inherent existence. It certainly doesn't mean that there is nothing, that everything's a black hole. Bhante Sangharakshita said once that a better translation for shunyata, which is the original Sanskrit term for the word emptiness, would have been fullness, which I found quite interesting. Phenomena arise in all their varied, weird and wonderful manifestations, but none of them has any inherent existence. And this relates back to the Buddha's deepest insight, out of which came his most fundamental teaching, which is the principle of paticca-samuppada, conditioned arising. So according to this principle, all phenomena, be they mental or material, arise in dependence upon conditions, and cease when those supporting conditions cease. Nothing inherently exists of itself as a freestanding entity. Every phenomena is a multiplicity of conditions, a process, a continuum. Any appearance of static entities is an illusion. So, for example, a mountain at any given moment may appear static, but the blades of grass on its slopes are growing or dying. Streams flow, rocks are being eroded by wind and water, and due to shifts in the earth's crust, the mountain itself is either growing or decreasing imperceptibly in height. No thing endures even for a split second. The one exception, at least in early Buddhism, is nirvana, which is said to be unconditioned, though in the perfection of wisdom tradition, even the distinction between samsara and nirvana is said to be empty. So the five skandhas are empty of inherent existence. What does this mean? What are the five skandhas? So skandha is a Sanskrit word, which along with Pali is the language that Buddhist texts were written down in, and it roughly translates as group, heap, or aggregate. So the five skandhas are five groups, heaps, aggregates. However, because they are conditionally arisen, these groups, these heaps, these aggregates, are not things. They themselves are processes which arise in dependence upon the presence of particular conditions and cease when those conditions are no longer present. As the famous saying says, this being that becomes, from the cessation of this, that ceases. So the five skandhas are the five processes that make up a human being. They are form, which is the body, their feeling, which is the hedonic tone of any experience, be it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, perception, i.e. the mental processes which classifies, labels, and interprets objects arising to the senses, volitional formations, that is our volitions, our emotions, and consciousness. Consciousness being the umbrella term for the consciousness of each of the senses of taste, touch, smell, sound, sight, and mind. And in Buddhism, mind's classified as a sixth sense. So the important thing to understand about each of the skandhas is that they are processes. They are never static for one moment, not even a micro moment. So the skandhas then are a way of breaking the human being down into constituent processes. So we're not an entity as such, but rather we're these five processes. And as previously indicated, these five constituent processes are themselves empty of any inherent existence. In the Fena Sutta, the Buddha likens the body to a lump of foam, feeling to bubbles on the water's surface, perception to a mirage, volitions to a plantain tree. A plantain tree is characterized by having no heartwood, so like a bamboo, it's empty on the inside, though very solid looking on the outside. And consciousness to a magical illusion. As he says in relation to form, monks, suppose that a large glob of foam were floating down this Ganges river, and a man with good eyesight were to see it, observe it, and appropriately examine it. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in a glob of foam? In the same way, a monk sees, observes, and appropriately examines any form that is past, future or present, internal or external, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near. To him, seeing it, observing it, and appropriately examining it, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance would there be in form? So the rest of the sutta goes on to describe the other four skandhas, i.e. feeling, perception, volitional formations and consciousness, in a similar way, that they're empty, they're void, they're without substance. Bhikkhu Anālayo, in his commentary on the Satipatthana Sutta, which we kind of use in Mitra study, the direct path to realization, he draws out the significance of the similes for each skandha, which I find quite useful. So as indicated, material form is likened to a glob of foam floating on the river. And Anālayo suggests that contemplating its unattractive and its insubstantial nature corrects mistaken notions of substantiality and beauty. Contemplating feelings to be like bubbles on the water's surface helps us to see their impermanent nature and counteracts the tendency to search for pleasure through feelings. Contemplating the nature of perceptions to be like a mirage, we become aware of their delusive quality, thereby uncovering, as Anālayo says, uncovering the tendency to project one's value judgments onto external phenomena, as if these were qualities of the outside objects. And this last point, it throws up an interesting point, doesn't it, that what we see and how we see it is actually determined by our predispositions. It's determined by our conditioning. It's determined by our karma. So what we actually notice in the world is, and how we notice it, is determined by our deeper drives, our deeper habits. And we used this example the other night, didn't we, Mickey? So, for instance, if I'm walking down the street, I tend to notice an attractive woman and miss the beautiful tree. And it's worth doing this. It's worth actually noticing what you immediately notice when you're walking down a road, but then, you know, with some mindfulness and recollection, noticing what you haven't previously noticed. And that starts to tell you something about your predispositions. It starts to tell you about where your sanskaras are moving. So Nalio goes on to say that contemplating our volitions as being empty, void, without substance, like a tree with no heartwood, helps. Well, it helps to correct the mistaken notion that willpower is the expression of a substantial self. And this is a big one, actually, because when it comes down to it, what our sense, you know, what our sense of self is most identified with is probably our sense of will. And it's interesting because I don't know if you've ever experienced that. When you're experiencing very strong ill will, you get quite a strong sense of a substantial me, that, hey, I really am someone. And it is just the strength of the volition. You know, it feels very much like, well, that's who we are. So we clearly feel it's me. But in reality, will and volitions, like everything else, are conditionally arisen. As Buddha Ghosha says, no doer of the deed is found, just bare phenomena roll on. So with regard to consciousness, contemplating it is a magic trick or illusion, empty, void, without substance. Analio suggests that this helps us to understand its deceptive performance, thereby counterbalancing the sense of cohesiveness and substantiality it tends to give to what in reality is a patchwork of impermanent and conditioned phenomena. So if we take the six consciousnesses to be the senses, and we did that exercise yesterday, didn't we, where we were actually sitting and just watching the arising and passing of things in the body, feelings, thoughts, and if you extend that to smells, tastes, sounds, you begin to just get this sense that everything's flickering and coming and going very quickly. So this idea of this consciousness being very stable, it quickly begins to break down. So returning to the opening line of the Heart Sutra, the Bodhisattva of compassion, when he meditated deeply, saw the emptiness of all five skandhas and sundered the bonds that caused him suffering. Why should this be so? Why would seeing the emptiness of the five skandhas with the bonds that caused him suffering be sundered? For an answer, we need to go back to the Buddha's noble truths. So with regard to the first noble truth, the Buddha says, birth is suffering, aging is suffering, sickness is suffering, death is suffering, association with the unpleasant is suffering. Dissociation from the pleasant is suffering. Not to receive what one desires is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to grasping are suffering. So in brief, the five aggregates subject to grasping are suffering. So as referred to previously, the aggregate is another term for skanda. So the five aggregates, the five skandhas, subject to grasping are suffering. We grasp after them, and we cling to them. Why does this result in suffering? Bhikkhu Bodhi, in a short essay on Subrahma's problem, puts it quite well. Fear and anxiety haunt the corridors of the mind because the mind is a function of time. Time means change, and change brings dissolution. The dissolution of the bonds we have forged with so much toil. To cling to anything is to aim at preserving it, at sealing it off from the ravenous appetite of time. Yet to make such an attempt is to run smack up against the fixed decree written into the texture of being, that whatever comes to be must pass away. And of course, it's not only the object of clinging that must yield to the law of impermanence. The subject too, the one who clings, and the very act of clinging are also bound to dissolve, perish, and pass away. So in the second noble truth, the Buddha indicates that the origin of suffering, as detailed in the first noble truth, is craving. It is this craving, thirst, which produces re-becoming, rebirth, accompanied by passionate greed, and finding fresh delight, now here and now there, namely craving for sense pleasure, craving for existence, and craving for non-existence. And according to the Buddha in his exposition, with regard to the conditioning factors which lead to the arising of dukkha, in dependence upon craving arises clinging. And as we've already indicated, the primary thing that we cling to are the five skandhas. Or another way of putting that is what we are trying to do is cling to a sense of a substantially existing, a truly existent self. Thus we cling to the five skandhas. The motivation is to bolster and maintain the sense of self, although no such personal self exists in the way we, the unenlightened, tend to conceive it. So we desperately cling on to the skandhas, we cling on to this sense of self, because this is all we conceive ourselves to be. And if we didn't have this, then we would have nothing. We would cease to be. We wouldn't exist. So we hold on for dear life. And ironically, it's this clinging that causes all the difficulties. Because if we could just relinquish this attachment and the personality beliefs that reinforce it, if we could let go, relinquish our attachment to the skandhas, we would find that actually we don't disappear, that we don't cease to be, but actually we would encounter, indeed we would partake of the deathless. Deathless being a synonym for nirvana. As the academic Peter Harvey writes, whatever one grasps at and identifies with I am limits one. Consequently, when a person lets go of everything such that his identity shrinks to zero, then citta expands to infinity. So it's by letting go. Citta is a term for heart-mind. It's translated as heart-mind. So you can see it in terms of your heart, mind, your consciousness expands to infinity. And this is perhaps what Pingyu was referring to when he said in his praises to the way to the beyond, you may consider this as mind released. Mind released. So it's the tenacious grip of clinging which keeps us bound to the rounds of existence and future suffering. And it's only by breaking its grip we can attain release. As Bodhi says in his introduction to the Khandavagga of the Samyutta Nikaya, khandhas, the Pali equivalent of skandha, the aggregates, i.e. the skandhas, are the objective domain of clinging, and as such contribute to the causal origination of future suffering. The removal of clinging is necessary for the attainment of release, and clinging must be removed from the objects around which its tentacles are wrapped, namely the five aggregates. So I'll just read that again. The aggregates are the objective domain of clinging and as such contribute to the causal origination of future suffering. The removal of clinging is necessary for the attainment of release, and clinging must be removed from the objects around which its tentacles are wrapped, namely the five aggregates, i.e. the five skandhas. Great. So how do we do this? How do we remove the tentacles of clinging from the five skandhas? How do we sunder the bonds that cause us suffering? Well, we do this through the cultivation of wisdom. As we're told in the Heart Sutra, the Bodhisattva holds to nothing whatever, but dwells in perfect wisdom. And the kind of wisdom needed is clear insight into the real nature of the skandhas. So in our ignorance, we cling to the skandhas, hoping that they'll give us pleasure, happiness, and security. But in truth, they're not a safe refuge. And deep down, we know this, and this is what leads a lot of us to suffer from underlying anxiety, which we, Vidanya, dealt with very well yesterday. We try to deny the truth. We try to push it away so that we can just get on and enjoy our lives. But deep down we know it. We're aware of our own mortality. We know everyone must die. We must die. And this knowledge, however unacknowledged, casts a shadow. We may try and push this reality away, but it returns in the form of fear, particularly at moments when our existential situation becomes all too apparent. So it's through wisdom that we're going to see the true nature of the skandhas. And with this wisdom, we will see they are not a safe refuge and abandon our clinging to them. So how then do we cultivate this wisdom into the true nature of the skandhas? The wisdom that will free us from delusive hindrance and free us from the fear bred by it. How do we attain to the Buddha's power of fearlessness? Well, we need to overturn one known as the viparyasas. And the viparyasas, again that's another Sanskrit word, are the distorted or upside down views whereby we see conditioned things as substantial, permanent, pleasurable and beautiful. And they're described as upside down views because in fact the primary characteristics of conditioned phenomena are that they're impermanent, that they're tinged with unsatisfactoriness, and that there's nothing in the least substantial about them. All phenomena bear these three marks of conditioned existence, the three lakshanas. Consequently, no thing can yield lasting satisfaction. To pursue conditioned things on the assumption they can is to be subject to frustration and disappointment. And it's by emotionally engaging in those things which are impermanent that gives rise to suffering, to dukkha. And the Buddha is clear that the skandhas are suffering because they tend to affliction and cannot be made to conform with our desires. So in a brief extract from the full reading of the sutta, which I read out on Friday night, he says in the Anatta Lakshana Sutta, "Form, monks, is not self. If form were self, this form would not lend itself to disease. It would be possible to say with regard to form, let this form be thus, let this form not be thus. But precisely because form is not self, form lends itself to disease. And it's not possible to say with regard to form, let this form be thus, let this form not be thus." And he repeats that formulation for the four other skandhas. So the skandhas are subject to change, and this change induces fear, distress, and anxiety. So Buddha says in another sutta, "Here, monks, the uninstructed worldling, with no regard for noble ones, unskilled and untrained in the Dharma of the noble ones, regards body as the self as having body, body as being in the self, or self as being in the body. Change occurs to this man's body, and it becomes different. Because of this change and alteration in his body, his consciousness is preoccupied with bodily change. Due to this preoccupation with bodily change, worried thoughts arise and persist, laying a firm hold on his mind. Through this mental obsession, he becomes fearful and distressed, and being full of desire and attachment, he is worried." Furthermore, the Buddha makes clear that attachment to the skandhas, clinging to the skandhas, leads to sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. There is a case where an uninstructed run-of-the-mill person is seized with the idea that I am form, or form is mine. As he is seized with these ideas, his form changes and alters, and he falls into sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair over its change and alteration. So the five aggregates are already suffering simply because they're impermanent, and they can never fulfill our hopes for happiness and security. The Buddha is clear that while they may give pleasure and joy, which is the gratification in them, eventually they must change and pass away, which is the danger perpetually concealed within them. So he says, "Bhikkhus, before my enlightenment, while I was still a bodhisattva, not yet fully enlightened, it occurred to me, what is the gratification? What is the danger? What is the escape in the case of form? Then, bhikkhus, it occurred to me, the pleasure and joy that arise in dependence upon form, This is the gratification in form. That form is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change. This is the danger in form. The removal and abandonment of desire and lust for this form. This is the escape from form. So the removal and abandonment of desire and lust for form. This is the escape from form. So the Buddha is pointing towards the development of disenchantment with regard to the five skandhas, to the development of dispassion towards them. However, in order to develop disenchantment and dispassion, we need to get underneath the five skandhas in terms of seeing them clearly as bearing these three marks. So how do we do this? Going back to the opening lines of the Heart Sutra, the Bodhisattva of compassion, when he meditated deeply, saw the emptiness of all five skandhas and sunder the bonds that caused him suffering. So he meditated deeply and he saw the emptiness of all five skandhas. So ultimately, we will not root out the deep-seated upside-down views by mere reflection, but only by meditating deeply. So how do we do this? Well, we develop concentration, and then we bring our focused mind to what's occurring in our experience. So it's a bit like what we did yesterday. And by that experience, I mean we are experienced through our six senses. We observe sensations, feelings, emotions, thoughts arising in the body and mind. We're aware of sounds, smells, sights, tastes, and objects of touch. And what we find is we will experience will simply be the ebb and flow of phenomena. The ebb and flow being none other than the lakshana of impermanence. And then it follows from that that because everything is permanent, no lasting or permanent satisfaction can be found within them. And we begin to see more clearly that by actually trying to cling and hold on to them, that they're dukkha, they cause suffering. And furthermore, it follows that everything is conditioned and impermanent, then all things are insubstantial and they can be seen not to be a fixed self. So this is Vipassana meditation, and Vipassana literally means a seeing into. And as we know, the Bodhisattva of compassion saw the emptiness of the five skandhas. He directly saw how things really are. So it's only by cultivating this insight that we can begin to break the tenacious grip, the tenacious clinging of the tentacles of ignorance around the five skandhas. The third mark of conditioned existence, anatta, or in Pali, anatman in Sanskrit, and this means simply not self. As Nyatiloka translates in his rather splendid Buddhist dictionary, which I highly recommend, the anatta doctrine teaches that neither within the bodily and mental phenomena of existence, nor outside of them, can be found anything that in the ultimate sense could be regarded as a self-existing real ego identity, soul, or any other abiding substance. So taking that further and penetrating it more deeply, Bhante Sangharakshita states in The Three Jewels, whilst the first lecture, Impermanence, affirms only that all conditioned things change, the second lakshana, penetrating far deeper, affirms there is no thing which changes. To abstract the thing which is changed from the process of change itself and set it up as an independent entity upon which change impinges, as it were, from the outside, is fallacious. So a common misperception when we talk about the notion of not-self and seeing it in terms of the three marks is that one has to somehow get rid of the ego. And this can create all kinds of difficulties because then we're setting ourselves up with a project of trying to get rid of something which actually doesn't exist. And this problem can be exacerbated if we mistakenly misinterpret in the Triratna system of practice, the stage of spiritual death. If we misinterpret that as somehow the enforced death of the self or the ego. Because the only thing that dies is an illusion. So it's interesting that on the spiral path, as taught by Bhante Sangharakshita, the stage after knowledge and vision of things as they really are, i.e. insight, is disenchantment. So disenchantment with conditioned things, one's no longer enchanted by them. So this is suggestive that actually we've been under the thrall of a magic spell that's actually made us see things in a deluded way. So it's breaking that spell. It breaks the illusion of a fixed, unchanging self. And then we realise there was never anything of that nature there in the first place. So there's no ego to be got rid of, but we just have to clearly see how the illusion of a substantial self is maintained through particular habits of mind. You know, because we wander around assuming I've got this fixed self and we just take that as read. But actually, we are a process, and there's a process of delusion at work. So actually this delusion is maintained independent upon conditions of us, albeit probably unconsciously, doing particular things. And these habits of mind, these particular things we do to sustain this illusion, are identifying with and appropriating our experience. So we have experience, and all the time we identify with it and we appropriate it. As Bhikkhu Bodhi says in his introduction to the Khandavagga, in clinging to the aggregates, one either grasps them with desire and lust and assumes possession of them, i.e. appropriates them, or one identifies with them, taking them as the basis for conceit or for views about one's real self. So we have this, as I said, largely unconscious habit of thinking about any experience arising through the skandhas, and that's the only places that experience can arise through, that this is mine, this is I am, this I am, this is myself. So this is mine is appropriation, which is a function of craving and grasping. So this is pretty straightforward. We're constantly reaching out and grasping at sense objects as a way of seeking to define ourselves, as a way of trying to fill our sense of inner poverty, or just seeking to reach out and grasp experiences. You know, when I was younger, I used to, you know, want to go to particular events or travel places, and then I could add it to my CV, so I've done this, I've done that. But the actual experience was, over time, it didn't seem to amount to very much, you know. So what if I went to see the Rolling Stones at Nebworth in 1976? I mean, it doesn't really, you know, well, actually, no, it's okay. But it's nice to chat about, but it doesn't kind of affirm me as a person. It doesn't actually give me that sense of substance in a way that I crave. This I am, this is myself, represents two types of identification. The first being expressive of conceit, i.e. this is who I am, and the second being this is what I am. So the first, conceit, is concerned with who I am, and we usually gauge this by comparing ourselves to others. So we're constantly comparing ourselves to other people, whether I'm bigger than them, smaller than them, older than them, younger than them, more attractive, less attractive, more intelligent, less intelligent. And we're doing this all the time, whether it's particularly consciously or often just at a very low level of grade of consciousness, really. It's flickering through. It's just such a habit of mind. And it's painful, you know, because seeing ourselves as either being superior or inferior to those around us, it serves to... We're desperately trying to bolster ourselves up or run ourselves down, which is kind of interesting, because actually by running ourselves down we're affirming our sense of self. You know, in fact, a lot of people go through life like this. They have a very negative self-view, but if you challenge that self-view, they get really quite tetchy about it, you know, because actually they've built a whole identity on what a sort of painful habits of mind. But also by this constant comparing ourselves with other people, it separates us from other people. It's always me here, them there. I'm like this, they're like that. So it separates us from our fellow human beings. So it separates us from reality, because in reality, we're not separate. You know, we're actually, you know, very, very connected. And seeing ourselves, and also seeing ourselves as the same, is an expressive of conceit. Because the truth is, we're an ebbing and changing process. And to try to compare ourselves with others, we necessarily have to think of both ourselves and the other person as being in some way fixed. Because the fact is, in reality, I might judge someone to be such and such, but then that person who I judge such and such, they've already changed, they've already kind of moved on, that process has moved on. And what's to say that particular characteristic which arose and depends upon conditions at any one particular time, who's to say whether that's is part of their being or not, whether it's just moved on? So we might even have certain character traits, but even these change over time. These rise and pass away in dependence upon conditions. And I found it interesting just reflecting on this in my own experience. It's like when we're young, we're told by our parents, you're like this, you know, you're a good boy, and you're good, you eat all your beans up, and you're good at English, but you're poor at maths. And we kind of, they've told us, so we grab onto that, and we kind of essentialise, you know, what is just a judgment of someone else about us. And then as we get older, and in the teenage years, they call it the formative years, don't they? The formative years. Well, kind of what happens is we start doing it for ourselves. So we might have particular emotional risings, for instance, which are quite habitual. And then what happens is we make the deduction, this is how I am, this is who I am. So we begin to, our parents teach us to start with, and then we begin to essentialise for ourselves around our experience. And as I say, we end up with a kind of quite a fixed view of who we are. And it's interesting that even if that's challenged, even the sort of so-called negative bits, we can get quite touchy about it in defensive cases. I really am weak and incompetent. You know, some say, no, you're not. You've got lots of good qualities. You go, no, I haven't. So it just shows how tenacious that is. We'd actually, rather be a sort of small negative person than sort of no one at all, in a sense. Though it is only in a sense, because as I've said, if we drop those ideas, something much, much bigger can actually emerge. So the second aspect of identification, this is myself, is identification with particular views. And the ninth nidana of the 12th nidana sequence leads to the arising of dukkha is, as we know, clinging. And as we've seen, the primary thing that we cling on to are the five skandhas as a substantial self. But this, as I've already touched on, is reinforced by clinging on to views, so views we have around ourselves. We derive a strong sense of self from these views. So we often define ourselves in terms of the views we hold. So we might say, well, I'm a Marxist, or I might say I'm a Tory, or I might even say I'm a Buddhist. But as a rule of thumb, we can say that the more tenaciously we hold on to a view, the more we're doing that, then the more we're deriving an identity from it. And indeed, we can notice the relative emotional charge that accompanies any of our views being challenged. So if we're very reactive and unwilling to engage in a considered discussion about the relative merit of a particular view, then it's pretty clear that we're holding onto that view tightly, that we're grasping onto it and consequently seeking to derive some kind of identity from it. So not for nothing did the Buddha exhort us to hold views lightly, even right view, well, especially right view. And as the Buddha taught, right view clung on to too tightly becomes wrong view through the very act of clinging to it. So how did the Buddha undermine these habits of mind? Well, he tenaciously saw all phenomena in terms of not mine, not I, and not self. And this exhortation crops up again and again in the suttas. So, for example, going back to the Anattalakshana Sutta, the Buddha asks the monks, What do you think, monks? Is form permanent or impermanent? Impermanent, Lord. And is that which is impermanent suffering or happiness? Suffering, Lord. And is it fitting to regard what is impermanent, suffering, subject to change, as this is mine, this is myself, this is what I am? No, Lord. Thus, monks, any form whatsoever that is past, future or present, internal or external, blatant or subtle, common or sublime, far or near, every form is to be seen as it actually is with right discernment, as this is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am. And he repeats this for each of the skandhas. Any feeling whatsoever is to be seen as it actually is with right discernment. This is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am. Any perception whatsoever is to be seen as it actually is with right discernment, as this is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am. Any volitional formation whatsoever is to be seen as it actually is with right discernment, as this is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am. Any consciousness whatsoever is to be seen as it actually is with right discernment, as this is not mine, this is not myself, this is not what I am. And the Buddha goes on to say, seeing thus, the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones grows disenchanted with form, disenchanted with feeling, disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with volitional formations, disenchanted with consciousness. Disenchanted, he becomes dispassionate. Through dispassion, he is fully released. With full release, there is knowledge. Fully released, he discerns that birth is ended, the holy life fulfilled, the task done. There is nothing further for this world. So this is great. The viparyasas are overturned. We see things how they really are, and we're fully released. But it's good to be aware that even though we're only dispelling an illusion, rather than killing off an ego or a substantial self, these illusions run deep and are tenaciously held. We cling to them through fear. If we are not this, then who are we? We're like the panicked rock climber, desperately clinging to the rock face, unable to move up or down, even when someone comes to help. When rescue is at hand, we're unable still to let go, because letting go induces fear. So it's important to acknowledge that to seek to undermine a strongly held view of things will induce fear. And of course the Buddha himself encountered fear. And in the Bahabharata Sutta, which Vedanya referred to yesterday, he relates how he dealt with the arising of fear and terror when he was practicing in the seclusion of the forest. When fear and terror came while I was walking back and forth, I would not stand or sit or lie down. I would keep walking back and forth until I had subdued that fear and terror. When fear and terror came while I was standing, I would not walk or sit or lie down. I would keep standing until I had subdued that fear and terror. When fear and terror came while I was sitting, I would not lie down or stand up or walk. I would keep sitting until I had subdued that fear or terror. When fear and terror came while I was lying down, I would not sit up or stand or walk. I would keep lying down until I had subdued that fear and terror. So it's probably a safe bet to suggest that, unlike us, the Buddha wouldn't have taken the arising of fear personally. If I experience the arising of fear, there's a sense that I'm scared. I need to get rid of this. I need to change the circumstances. I need to do something different. If I'm meditating and fear starts arising, I think, well, I better stop meditating. But the Buddha would have clearly seen the arising of fear as just another conditioned arising in the mind, and clearly comprehended it as not mine, not I, not self. He would have subdued the fear and terror by seeing through it, not by trying to run away from it. And at some point, if we are really to free ourselves from clinging and the dukkha that it leads to, that is what we're going to have to do. And later, of course, on the eve of his enlightenment, the Buddha was accosted by Mara and his hordes. Terrible apparitions rose up before him. But by this time, the Buddha had already reached a stage of high equanimity, dispassion, and he saw through Mara and his hordes as no more than the empty play of the mind. And the arrows and spears hurled by the last remnants of the darkness of ignorance in his mind fell like rose petals around him. And it's worth noting, though, that in the aforementioned Bhayabhareva Sutta, the Buddha gives a long list of factors which also condition the arising of fear and terror in those who resort to isolated forests or wildernesses. And most of these are associated with indulging in unskillful actions of body, speech and mind. So it's interesting in the Kimitta and Chaitanya suttas, which appear in the Anguttara Nikaya, a spiral path is outlined which arises not from dukkha, but from ethical practice. So that in dependence upon wholesome and virtuous behaviour arises non-regret. In dependence upon non-regret arises joy. And then we're into the sequence which leads through rapture, tranquility and bliss, to concentration, vision of things as they really are, and onwards up to disenchantment, dispassion and liberation. So that's interesting because one can see very clearly in this sequence the threefold way of sila, samadhi, pranaya, that is ethics, meditation and wisdom. So before we try to see more clearly into the way things are, we need to clear obstacles out of the way by developing our ethical practice. And this points back to the Triratna system of practice. That is, it's only on the basis of integration and positive emotion, which one can roughly equate with the development of strong ethical practice and a stable mind capable of concentration, that we're going to be able to have the necessary conditions in place to really see how things are, to dispel the darkness of ignorance, which is productive of delusion and fear. They're not necessary conditions, they're vital conditions. But it's important not to settle down in those stages. As the Buddha in his final exhortation to his followers said, with mindfulness strive on. With mindfulness undermine the illusion of mine, undermine the illusion of I, and undermine the illusion of self, and attain to the Buddha's power of fearlessness. Thank you.